What could they see but a hideous and desolate wilderness, full of wild beasts and wild men? Savage barbarians, readier to fill their sides full of arrows than otherwise. The whole country, full of woods and thickets, represented a wild and savage hue.
The more I looked, the more I liked it. I did not think that in all the known world it could be paralleled. I found two sorts of people, the one Christians, the other infidels. These I found most full of humanity and more friendly than the other.
The place is New England, the time the 1620s, and the men who wrote these words would become the bitterest of enemies.
If they looked behind them, there was the mighty ocean, which was now as a main bar and gulf to separate them from all the civil parts of the world. They agreed to enclose their dwellings with a good strong pale, with gates to shut, which were every night locked and a watch kept to prevent Indian treachery.
The savages are willing that anyone shall eat with them. Nay, if anyone that shall come into their houses and they see him disposed to lie down, they will spread a mat for him. If he sleep until their meat be dished up, they will wake him, saying, "If you be hungry, there is meat for you." Such is their humanity.
One was William Bradford, the governor of Plymouth Colony. The band of pilgrims who had fled religious oppression in England, been unhappy in Holland, and landed on the Massachusetts coast in 1620. The other was Thomas Morton, a lawyer who came to the New World hoping to profit in the fur trade. He had settled about 50 miles north of the pilgrims on a hilltop he called Marymount, or Mountain by the Sea. Bradford scornfully dubbed it Marymount, a name that has stuck.
They fell to great licentiousness and led a dissolute life. They also set up a maypole, drinking and dancing about it many days together, inviting the Indian women for their consorts, dancing and frisking together like so many fairies, or furies rather, and worse practices.
The harmless mirth made by young men that lived in hope to have wives brought over to them was much distasted of the precise separatists, troubling their brains more than reason would require about things that are indifferent. And from that time sought occasion against my honest host of Marymount to overthrow his undertakings and to destroy his plantation quite and clean.
Mine host is what Morton calls himself, in a book that would be ignored or dismissed for centuries by historians who called him a worthless rake, a reckless libertine, an amoral adventurer, a scoffer, America's first rascal. But poets and writers were finding in it a moment in time when a national identity was at stake, when the bedrock of a nation was forming, but at great, sometimes horrifying, human cost.
The future complexion of New England was involved in this important quarrel. Should the grisly saints establish their jurisdiction over the gay sinners, then would their spirits darken all the clime and make it a land of clouded visages, of hard toil, of sermon and psalm forever. But should the banner staff of Marymount be fortunate, sunshine would break upon the hills, and flowers would beautify the forest, and late posterity do homage to the maypole. Nathaniel Hawthorne.
When the first settlers came to their first Christmas in Plymouth, and some of them went out to celebrate Christmas as Englishmen did back in the Old World, Bradford came swooping down on them and got rid of their Christmas celebration, immediately banished them to their houses, and then he exults, "We never had another celebration of Christmas in my life. At least not in public," he says. "I can't tell what they did behind their doors." They got rid of sacraments, they got rid of icons, they got rid of music, they got rid of incense, everything that appealed to the senses, everything that got in the way of a direct relation to God.
Michael Zuckerman, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, says posterity is indeed doing homage to the maypole.
The recent stuff by historians has been not always directly about Morton, but has been an enormous reexamination of the issues that Morton raises. And whereas there used to be a pretty unadulterated celebration of the Puritans as our true spiritual ancestors, he begins to look like our ancestor, and the Puritans, a hopeless minority of the society, still as passionate as ever, still as self-righteous as ever, but no longer speaking for America.
The story begins in the west of England, where young Morton learns to hunt and trap and fish, to train falcons, to see the natural world through the eyes of English poets and Greek and Roman writers of antiquity.
The celebration of nature as a garden of delights, a place where we could all have our desires come true.
John Dempsey is a Morton scholar who has taught at Brown University and Wheaton College.
They would have these grand roving banquets all over the landscape, and the women's dresses would be half falling off by the time they came home. Thomas Morton is probably walking around most of the time in a silk shirt or an overcoat with slashed sleeves, as they called it. The sleeves were slashed to show the quality of your undergarments. He loved to show off. That was one of the objections that the Puritans themselves had to the upper classes at that time, that they dressed decadently. They had laws in Boston saying that you could only have certain types of buttons on your clothing.
It was a time of high spirits and low necklines, and Thomas Morton was a man of his time. He went to London and studied law, watched Shakespeare in the Globe Theater, drank in the Mermaid Tavern with Ben Jonson, and pursued the bawdy pleasures of an age that was coming to an end.
There were two renaissances going on. One was about the revival of ancient pagan European culture, and the other was a renaissance of biblical values, which the Puritans wanted to see. Now, Thomas Morton was, in our sense of the term, in every way, a Renaissance man. He believed in culture, in learning, in the toleration of difference. He believed in a joyful sexuality and a healthy relationship to nature. These are all parts of what we call the Renaissance, the rebirth of learning.
Three years into Morton's New World adventure, the trading post is failing. Its leader, a Captain Wollaston, leaves, and Morton, left with a collapsing business venture and seven indentured servants, does a remarkable thing. He frees the young men from their bonds of servitude and makes them equal partners in the fur trade, a move that infuriates Bradford.
They saw that they should keep no servants, for Morton would entertain any, how vile soever. And all the scum of the country or any discontents would flock to him from all places if this nest was not broken. And they should stand in more fear of their lives and goods in short time from this wicked and debased crew than from the savages themselves.
The separatists, envying the prosperity and hope of the plantation at Murray Mount, which they perceived began to come forward and to be in a good way for gain in the beaver trade, conspired together against mine host especially, and made up a party against him, and mustered up what aid they could, accounting of him as a great monster.
Morton sees it at that point in his narrative as economic. Morton sees it as they wanted to get rid of the competition. There is no doubt that Morton was doing splendidly in trading with the Indians, and the Pilgrims were doing badly. If you were an Indian, who would you want to trade with? It's also the case that the Pilgrims needed to worry mightily about this because the Puritans were hugely in debt and they were getting endless dunning letters from their representatives back in England and back in Holland saying, you got to send us stuff.
Morton, thinking himself lawless and hearing what gain the French and fishermen made by trading of pieces, powder and shot to the Indians, began the practice of the same in these parts. At first he taught them how to use them, to charge and discharge. So as the Indians are full of pieces all over, both fowling pieces, muskets, pistols, etc. Oh, the horribleness of this villainy. How many, both Dutch and English, have been lately slain by those Indians thus furnished? He sold them all he could spare.
Governor Bradford's list of grievances is piling up, and this one seems to goad him to action. The Pilgrims, Morton says, have threatened to harm him and burn his house down. Bradford puts it differently.
Those of Plymouth first resolved jointly to write to him, and in a friendly and neighborly way to admonish him to forbear those courses, and sent a messenger to bring his answer. But he was so high as he scorned all advice, with scurrilous terms full of disdain. They sent to him a second time. He answered in high terms as before, and that the king's proclamation was no law demanding what penalty was upon it. Upon which they saw there was no way but to take him by force.
And taking advantage of the time when his company were gone up into the inlands to trade with the savages for beaver, they set upon my honest host at a place called Wessaguscus, and they charged him with criminal things. Much rejoicing was made that they had gotten their capital enemy, Six persons of the conspiracy were set to watch him. But in the dead of night, up gets mine host, and got to the second door, which, notwithstanding the lock, he got open, and shut it after him with such violence that the word was given, "Oh, he's gone! He's gone!"
At this point in his narrative, Morton gives us a scene from the Marx Brothers and uses satire, his favorite weapon, to cut Miles Standish, a man of small stature, down to size.
The rest start up in amaze and, like rams, ran their heads one at another full butt in the dark. Their leader, Captain Shrimp, took on most furiously and tore his clothes for anger. The rest were eager to have torn their hair from their heads, but it was so short that it would give them no hold. Now, Captain Shrimp thought in the loss of this prize, all his honor would be lost forever.
So they sent Captain Standish and some other aide to take Morton by force. But they found him to stand stiffly in his defense, having made fast his doors, armed his consorts, set diverse dishes of powder and bullets ready on the table.
The nine worthies coming before the den of the supposed monster offered quarter if mine host would yield. But mine host no sooner had set open the door and issued out, but instantly Captain Shrimp and the rest of the worthies stepped to him, laid hold of his arms, and had him down. And so eagerly was every man bent against him that they fell upon him as if they would have eaten him.
Neither was there any hurt done to any of either side, save that one was so drunk that he ran his own nose upon the point of a sword as he entered the house. But he lost but a little of his hot blood.
So these worthies set mine host upon an island, without gun, powder, or shot, or dog, or so much as a knife to get anything to feed upon, or any other clothes to shelter him with at winter than a thin suit which he had on at that time. Upon this island he stayed a month at least, and from this place for England sailed mine host in a Plymouth ship.
They intended him to die. He was just hardy enough that he foiled their plan. But finally the ship picks him up and takes him back, and for the first time he's actually indicted in a court after they've convicted him already, after they've punished him already, comes the indictment and the trial. These guns that Morton was accused of selling were in fact wonderfully useful to the Indians, but for shooting animals. As far as fighting the Europeans was concerned, we've got a lot of research now that suggests that bows and arrows were at least as good, probably better. An Indian could put six arrows in you before you got off your second shot. The Indians were getting guns with or without Morton. The Indians continued to get guns after they got rid of Morton. The Indians had guns before they knew Thomas Morton. The charge doesn't make sense.
But though he went for England, yet nothing was done to him. Not so much as rebuked, for what was heard, but returned the next year.
Installed again at Merrymount, Morton resumes fur trading, and this time leaves the sale of guns to others. But the maypole, an 80-foot pine stripped of its branches and crowned with a pair of antlers, the maypole is gone. In a symbolic gesture Freud would have appreciated, the Puritans have cut it down.
Woe to the youth or maiden who did but dream of a dance. The selectman nodded to the constable, and there sat the light-heeled reprobate in the stocks, or if he danced, it was round the whipping post, which might be termed the Puritan maypole. Nathaniel Hawthorne.
The maypole is a phallus, and says sexuality is visible and sexuality is a major part of life. The maypole is also traditional. The maypole is exactly a pagan festival. The maypole is a symbol of the interracial relations. And then it's also commercial. It's a beacon out there on the coast for everybody to see and to know where Thomas Morton's trading post is.
Now, there is a new and much larger colony closer to him, Massachusetts Bay. And one of its first judicial acts is to arrest Thomas Morton. He is set in the stocks, stripped of his properties, imprisoned, and banished. The Puritans wait until he sails into exile to burn his house down so that he will see Merrymount in flames across the water.
This time, Morton doesn't go quietly. Instead, he forces them in the middle of winter. See, you don't go across the Atlantic usually in the middle of the winter. So he forced them to put him on ship with block and tackle. hoisted aboard a ship like a cow in a harness, so that the whole crowd watching could see clearly that Thomas Morton was not getting on the ship under his own will. He knew that this was probably a death voyage.
The Puritans were just tougher birds than the Pilgrims. They arrested him on a warrant which was so specious, they simply refused to put that warrant into their records, because they knew that if anybody ever looked at that warrant, there was no color of law whatsoever to justify the arrest.
If Jove vouchsafe to thunder, the charter and kingdom of the separatists will fall asunder. Repent, you cruel schismatics, repent. These things have happened, and I shall see their merciless cruelty rewarded with condign punishment for coming into those parts, like Samson's foxes with firebrands at their tails.
But this thorn in the flesh of the saintly colonists will not go away. Morton survives the voyage and turns to the law for his revenge.
He's so physically debilitated by that trip that it takes him apparently 6 to 9 months just to recover from that. Within a year, he files a petition to the court saying that the Puritans have indeed abused their powers under the king's charter, and not just Morton is a complainant under that petition, but several other people who are recognizable to the nobility. This is the mistake the Puritans made, in the sense they made a very capable lawyer angry and let him live.
As the petition wends its way through the court, Morton begins to write New English Canaan, an account of the New World that likens it to the biblical promised land. A land of amazing bounty, overflowing with fish and game, a land in every way superior to Old England.
Contained within the volume of the land are fowls in abundance, fish in multitude, and millions of turtle doves on the green boughs, which sat pecking of the full, ripe, pleasant grapes. Here and there, dispersed, you might see lilies, and of the Daphnian tree, which made the land to me seem paradise. For in mine eye it was nature's masterpiece. If this land be not rich, then is the whole world poor.
One third of the book is a detailed description of the flora and fauna of New England, almost the only natural history of the period. And for a reason, Professor Zuckerman says, that goes to the heart of Puritan doctrine.
All of nature, for Bradford, for any pilgrim, any Puritan, has to be sinful. What's natural comes from the devil, what's natural is tainted by original sin. They build houses with the teensiest little windows, with oil paper covering their windows, so that the light scarcely comes in the daytime. They're living inside in the dark, in the middle of summertime. They build fences around their towns. They build walls. All their sermons speak of the wall and the garden. And the garden is inside. The garden is that which you've cultivated, where you grow your little beans and your little peas. It isn't the woods out there. The woods out there terrify them. The woods out there are not majestic scenery. The woods out there are wolves and bears and lions. This earth everywhere is just a veil of tears. The real trick, it's to keep your focus on heaven.
A trick not easily achieved. A man is put to death for bestiality. Adultery is a criminal offense. Puritan handbooks warn against, quote, wanton speeches and foolish dalliance in the marriage bed. Thomas Morton is the first, but not the last, in a long line of people who are deported or expelled for religious, political, or sexual reasons.
When the Puritans brought somebody into court, they would try them for whatever their crime was, their drunkenness, their fornication, their adultery. That they would convict them for. But you were also expected to confess your sinfulness, to humble your pride, and to submit to the community. And if you persisted in denying that you were guilty, then they came down on you with a punishment 5 times as harsh. Pride, the assertion of self, individualism, these were the unthinkable things.
Morton gives equal space to Native Americans, observing their customs and characteristics with the zest of an anthropologist, another radical departure from the spirit of the time.
It is a thing to be admired, and indeed made a precedent, that a nation yet uncivilized should more respect age than some nations civilized. The younger are always obedient unto the elder people, and at their commands in every respect without grumbling. In all councils, the younger men's opinion shall be heard, but the old men's counsel embraced and followed. The consideration of these things, methinks, should reduce some of our irregular young people to better manners and make them ashamed of their former error in this kind.
25 years ago, the prevailing orthodoxy was that the Puritans were pretty good with Indians. There has scarcely been a nice thing written about Puritans and Indians for the last 25 years. The Puritans view the Indians as scarcely there at all. The Puritans have a doctrine that this is vacant land. All Europeans had theories that were like this. And the Indians are creatures of the devil. There's no question about that. They use those terms. They paint them as red. They see them as hellish, satanic. These are their words, not my words. And Morton is clearly suggesting that these people can coexist and that the world can be shared.
The final third of Morton's book is a satirical and unsparing portrait of his enemies. For this literary extravaganza, full of classical and biblical allusions and bursts of poetry, is also an instrument of revenge, a sales pitch to encourage migration and the overthrow of Puritan rule. In 1634, Morton has reason to be jubilant.
They indeed get what they want. The king is so incensed at the treatment of many of his subjects and so forth under the Puritan law that they formally revoke the charter. The crowning irony here is simply that by this time, King Charles himself and his awful ways are generating the beginnings of the English Civil War. So the government is so caught up with its resources trying to handle that, that they have nobody that can actually physically go back and take the charter from the Puritans in New England.
In fact, the English colonists have taken over more land, a natural result, according to one historian, of a terrain so rock-strewn it was said to produce Yankee sheep with sharpened noses. Massachusetts Bay has launched its first slave ship, the Desire. A smallpox epidemic and a massacre have devastated the native population.
It's actually incomparably more the Europeans who are a danger to the Indians than the Indians who are a danger to the Europeans. They have no concept of total warfare. They do not attack and destroy entire communities. In the Pequot War of 1637, the Puritans literally intend to obliterate the Pequots from the face of the earth. They're burning people alive. They're incinerating women and children by the dozens. Their Indian allies are horrified by this. They've never seen warfare like this. They've never seen violence on this scale. And they scream at the Puritans, enough, enough, it's too much. And the Puritans go on mercilessly.
In 1642, Charles I is beheaded, and England plunges into civil war. Morton, a known royalist, has reason to worry, as Puritans lead the rebellion against the crown. Then he does an astonishing thing.
He goes right into the mouth of the wolf, comes back to New England, not to Virginia, where he would have just mixed quite happily in among the royalists down there, but to New England.
There are alternatives. I think he underestimates, much as he hates the Puritans, much as he's just written a book maligning the Puritans, he underestimates just how venomous they are. It doesn't occur to him that they would know the book that he's written. He has no way of knowing that a letter that he wrote 10 years before, a private letter, has been treasured by the Puritan authorities against the possibility of his return. This is a place that sings to him. This is a place that calls to him.
Morton himself says he is going to end his days in the place he loves. When he arrives in Plymouth, close to 70, this incurable optimist has in his pocket a charter for a new colony in Maine. But before he can round up a company, he is arrested, clapped in irons, and put in a cell without a fire or bedding. The New England winter does the rest. When he is released a year later, his health is broken, and he dies soon after. This was very close to Marymount.
A morning's walk up the coast. If you think of Morton coming up here some morning with his dogs, he's just had breakfast with corn and venison and etc., and he comes 2 miles up the coast and he finds starving pilgrims up here, starving Puritans. They were dying of fevers, starvation, dysentery, etc. What's the problem, he wants to know. I'm two miles down the coast and there's no problem.
I think when all is said and done, the essential threat that Thomas Morton represented is manifest in one of his simplest acts.
He comes back in the fall of 1629 after his first arrest for all his crimes and misdemeanors and sexual offenses and gun trade and etc. and etc. And the pilgrims say, "What are you doing here? I can't believe you've come back." And he says, "Well, I have come back. Goodbye." And he walks out of Plymouth into the devil's country, the wilderness. That's his threat. He's not afraid. He's not afraid of native people. He's not afraid to be alone in the woods. He's not afraid.
Back in 1882, a historian wrote, "It has been considered well nigh a proof of loyalty to treat his memory with scorn." Does today's cultural bias do to the Puritans what generations of Yankee prejudice did to Morton? These were not footloose adventurers or rugged outdoorsmen, but men, women, and children dying of fever, cold, and hunger, attempting a radical experiment in the wilderness. In another 25 years, will history be rewritten again? Has the pendulum swung too much in the opposite direction? Wouldn't anyone have been afraid?
I think that the answer is no. Whole colonies were not afraid. Virginia didn't stay huddled in little communities within walls. This is a group that's terrified. And some of its terrors are still some of our terrors.
But they weren't too terrified to go up against the whole Church of England.
This is part of what's so fascinating about them, that these are people of extraordinary courage, extraordinary conviction, and at the same time, psychological basket cases. They feel stirring within themselves the impulses to freedom which Morton represents. He is everything that tempts them, everything that they have defeated in themselves but that won't stay down.
I have seen an oyster bank a mile at length. Mussels there are infinite store. Clams our swine feed upon, and of them every shore is full. The savages are much taken with the delight of this fish and are not cloyed, notwithstanding the plenty. These things I offer to your consideration, courteous reader, and require you to show me the like in any part of the known world.
It was the tongue in your cheek they hated most, wrote Stephen Vincent Benet, the last flare of old England, the reckless mirth. Thomas Morton has had to wait almost 400 years for his revenge, but he might have appreciated the joke.
When a psalm was pealing from their place of worship, the echo which the forest sent them back seemed often like a roar of laughter. Who but the fiend and his bond slaves, the crew of Merrymount, had thus disturbed them?
I'm Helen Borton, producer of A Sense of Place. Voices: Nick Armstrong, David Winyard, and Charles Flowers. Production assistants: Larry Borton. Special thanks to John Dempsey, whose modern edition of New English Canaan made our work easier. Mix by Marilyn Reese. This series is funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional support from the New York State Council on the Arts and the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the MacArthur Foundation. Sponsorship by the New York Foundation for the Arts.